Again, this is the opportunity to really develop your mind in deep states of meditation. And through developing, I just have to find your own distance. If during this first talk you can't hear at the back, please stand up or gesticulate to let me know whether you can hear or not. Can you hear at the back? That's okay, very good. So, the next 4 days, we're going to work to see how we can allow our mind to become peaceful and still. As I was saying last night in the first talk I gave, if you regard samadhi as stillness, and sama samadhi is the last factor of the Eightfold Path, it's a perfect stillness. The stillness of the jhanas. Then you understand what we're doing here in the next 4 days. To see how much we can still our minds. However, don't just aim for jhanas. If you aim for jhanas, you'll be aiming for the wrong thing. You're aiming for the result, not the cause. Instead, we should be aiming for stillness. Aim for the cause. It's like the person who wanted their dishes to be washed up. And they went into their kitchen and said, oh, when are my dishes going to be clean? I want my dishes to be clean. Why can't my dishes become clean? And the more time that they waste thinking about that, the longer it will take to clean the dishes. In other words, if you want to have clean dishes in your kitchen, you have to, what is the cause for clean dishes? And it's called washing up. So instead of just wanting the dishes to be clean, instead you want to wash the dishes. So you put forth the effort and create the causes for clean dishes. And after a short while, you find all the dishes are sparkling and radiant. In the same way, those of you who come here to attain jhanas, and you think, I haven't achieved jhanas yet, when am I going to achieve jhanas? It's not fair, everyone else has achieved jhanas, but not me. Don't ever think like that. Instead, to think, what is the cause for these deep states of meditation? And just like the cause of clean dishes is washing them, so the cause of jhanas is creating stillness in the mind. And when that stillness gets deep enough, then the jhanas come. And just like the dishes are clean and radiant and sparkling, so your mind is clean, sparkling and radiant of the jhanas. So please remember, just what you're aiming for is stillness. Sometimes people again get confused because in Sri Lanka and many other parts of the world, many teachers were misguiding and misinforming people to say that you do not need jhanas to attain insight. But please understand what I was saying yesterday. And please understand what is said very clearly in the suttas, that you do need those jhanas to gain insight. As the Buddha said again many, 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 many times, that it is from the cause of stillness, the samadhipaccaya, that you see things as they truly are. Samadhipaccaya yatha bhuta jnana dasana. It is from the cause of samadhi that you see things as they truly are. And also the Buddha said that without that samadhi, that sama samadhi of jhanas, he said the cause for wisdom, I'm talking about the enlightenment wisdom, just isn't there. So you'll be meditating for year after year and still not see the Dhamma. And maybe later on when I start talking about the wisdom which comes from jhanas, you'll understand that in more depth. But here I will just mention one of my stories, a story from the experience of my life, which I think many of you can relate to, which shows you the connection between stillness and the deep insights. And that is the simile of the road which goes up to my monastery. Many of you have heard this before, but it is a very beautiful simile of how stillness gives rise to deep sea. And also, that where happiness comes from, where pitisukha comes from, and why it is a sign that the mind is ready for insight. The story is this, that in my monastery in Western Australia, it's situated on top of a small hill, but it has beautiful views over to the west and to the ocean, the Indian Ocean. For 9 years, I'd been living in that monastery. And you would go into town 2 or 3 times a week. So I'd always go up and down the hill, which led to my monastery, in a vehicle. The journey from the bottom of the hill to the top where the monastery was situated was about just over 2 kilometres. For 9 years I've been going up and down that hill in a car. But there was one day I was returning from some appointment in town. And it was a lovely morning, spring morning. And I had plenty of time, and I felt I needed the exercise. So I asked my driver, please let me out at the bottom of the hill, I want to walk up. And he let me out. Sometimes it's very hard as a monk to walk. Sometimes if I asked to walk, he said, no, 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 we'll give you a lift. No, I insist on walking. No, no, you must go in the car. And sometimes if I do start walking, somebody else stops to give me a lift. So sometimes it's hard to get exercise as a monk. But nevertheless, here I demanded to get out of the car and walk up the hill. The 2 kilometres would usually take about half an hour. This one took me about an hour. Because when I started walking, I had a strange experience of not being able to recognize the scenery around me. Even though I'd lived in that monastery for 9 years and gone up and down that hillside and looked through the window, now I saw something completely different than anything I could remember. How was it I couldn't see the things I now saw? Through the window of a speeding car. I saw so much more detail. The rocks, the grasses, the bushes, the trees. And it was more beautiful than I'd ever seen before. And it was so strange an experience that I stopped and stood still. And when I stood still, the scenery changed again. Now I could see even more detail. And what I saw became more beautiful. The colours became richer. And the textures stood out. It was such a strange experience that I contemplated it as I was walking up the hill, and I contemplated it later. How come that I thought I knew that hillside, and now I'm seeing it as if for the first time? And I realize, as many of you I hope would understand, that this is just the physical nature of your senses. If you imagine yourself sitting in a car looking through the window, you're travelling so fast that the image which forms in the back of your eye does not have a chance to fully form before that image is dislodged by another view, and the mind has to attend to that. In fact, that the way that most people live their lives, you don't look long enough to fully see. When I started walking, my eye had more time to see things. As I looked, the colours began to become richer on the back of my eye, on the retina. You could see more details. The image had more time to form. That's why when I went slower by walking, I saw more. And when I stopped, only then did my eye have enough time to see the full picture. I'm not sure if any of you, when you were young, developed your own photographs in a little lab. I remember in science class taking a photograph and developing it myself. And as you put the photographic paper in sort of the chemicals, it takes a few minutes for the image to form. And you see it slowly forming. First of all, just a silhouette. And as the chemical reaction continues, you can see more detail and the colours fully form. If you take it out too soon, you get a washed out image. This is precisely what happens with the chemistry at the back of the eye. If you move too quickly, all you see is just a fraction of what's there. And the colours you see are dull. Everything you see when you are rushing too fast is not fully formed. The slower you go, the more you see. The deeper you see, and that hillside never looked so beautiful as it did when I was still. Only then were the colours really rich. Instead of looking grey, there were greens, were brilliant greens. The greys were deep greys. Everything was more intense, more beautiful, with more detail. Now this is a beautiful simile about the connection between stillness and seeing deeply. If you don't believe me, when you go home, if you're a person who always goes from your front door to the office or even to the corner of the street in your car, try walking. And you will find you will see things you never saw through the window of your car. You'll see more detail, you'll notice much more. In the same way, that when you learn stillness of the mind, you see much more of what's going on. Too many people in life live their lives as if in a speedy car, looking through the window. You're doing so much, going so fast, that you think you see and recognize your surroundings. You only see a fraction of what's there. And what you see is not rich, nor beautiful. One of the causes of the modern disease of depression is because people see life washed out of all beauty and detail. Why? Because they live life too fast. If people would only slow down and do less, what they see, what they feel, what they taste will be more delicious, and their depression will mostly go. For example, the first time I went on a meditation retreat, I was a student at Cambridge. And a little group of meditators, we hired 2 boarding houses in Cambridge during the vacation. Now for those of you who have done studies in England a long time ago, or who have visited that place, you will know that one of the things which England was noted for 30, 40 years ago was how tasteless was their food. They had no taste at all, and anybody from Asia, it was a great deal of austerity to eat the food at an English restaurant or cafe. The French used to mock the English for how they always had 3-course meals, and no matter what course it was, it always tasted the same. Even vegetables, any taste was boiled out, and so the whole cuisine was bland. And of all of the cooks or chefs in that country, the very worst, the bottom of the pile, were the cooks employed in boarding houses for poor students. So when I signed up for this retreat for 9 days, I thought, oh my goodness, the food is going to be terrible. I know it's going to be awful. It's going to have no taste at all. Boarding house cooking for students. But nevertheless, I was not there for the food, I was there for the meditation. But to my surprise, at that retreat, the food was delicious. At first, I thought, I must have struck lucky. I must have got the best cook in all the boarding houses of that country. Now I know different. It wasn't the cook which made the food delicious. It was the stillness of my mind, which improved my mindfulness enough to see the little bit of taste which was left after the cook had got through all that food. It was a sensitivity The same process which allowed me to see the beauty of a hillside in more detail than I ever expected to find also enabled me to taste more of the flavor in the food. What stillness is doing is increasing the power of your mind. You're seeing more, and what you're seeing is deeper, richer, and more enjoyable. So on this little mini retreat, a sign that your meditation is improving can be how delicious the food tastes. If it tastes more delicious than you've ever tasted before, then your meditation is going well. And the moral of that story is, if ever you go out to a good restaurant and spend a lot of money on a big meal, always meditate beforehand for half an hour so you get your money worth. But this is not just about enjoying your food. This is to show you how the more still you are, the deeper you see. When you're moving too fast, even the mind can't explore what you're seeing. So what happens? You just don't really understand it. Now, I'll give you a little exercise. What's this which I'm holding in my right hand? What is it? Anyone know? This chap now. Stand here. What else is it? Did we get anything else? You see? Doesn't remember anything else? Go on, is anything else? Sure, keep on looking. Holding, yes, keep on looking. Now this is an exercise which I often give on meditation retreats. When I held this up and said, what is this? Many of you said, stand. And if I hadn't asked you to look more, you'd have left it at that and finished with it. This is the trouble when we're not still enough. We give it a name, stand, we think that's it. We look at this mic, I jump around, we think that's it. There's much more to it than that. But the way we look at things, we look, give it a name, think we know, and then leave it to go on to something else. Which is why we never see deeply into anything. The labels are all we see, but we never see beyond that. Once there was a man in Australia who went to the most expensive restaurant in town. The maitre d' gave him the menu. This beautiful menu on parchment where the dishes were written in gold. He proceeded to eat the menu, pay, and left. And that man left hungry as he went in. Do you understand the symbol of eating the menu? Eating the menu is like someone who eats the labels but never understands what the labels are pointing to. Who thinks that this is a stand and nothing else. Who can read the sutras and recite them all but never understands what they mean. Someone who eats the menu left by the Buddha called the Sutta Pitaka. Now, if you just eat menus, you're not going to be very fit and healthy. The menu is there to point to the food. Stand. There's much more than that. When we move too fast, we hardly understand anything at all. So in order to see things deeply, we have to be so still. Stand. Metal. Tubular. Keep on looking. Until you can look at something for a long time. And you can see things you never expected to see. Way beyond the labels. Deep into the nature of something. Beyond all you've ever learned and been taught. That's what stillness does. But the other part of stillness, which is important, is that when I looked at that hillside, it was so beautiful. When I tasted food on that retreat, it was so delicious. If you look at a stand for long enough, it glows so beautifully. Some monks through meditation on corpses. I too have a human skull in my room. Sometimes I advise people as a joke that everybody should get a skeleton or a skull and put it in front of your front door. It's much better than the burglar alarm, because when any burglar comes in and sees a skeleton or a skull, they'll run a mile. So even some people go to my room, which I keep my lock, and they see my skull there, and they go out very quickly. But sometimes we meditate on the skull, and the strange thing happens when you look with stillness on a skull or a decomposing corpse. The skull starts to become incredibly beautiful. It's the most beautiful skull you've ever seen, ever. And it's delightful. When those things started to happen to me, I thought, am I going deviant? Is this weird? That, you know, you're getting off and getting blissed out and watching a piece of human anatomy. And the point was, no, it is the stillness makes even a lump of human excrement look beautiful. It's so brown, it's so rich, it's got such wonderful texture. Now the thing is, with Alexander, it's not the thing in itself. The beauty, the delight is coming from the nature of the mindfulness. As you become more still, your mindfulness becomes stronger. You see more, and what you see becomes more delightful. The happiness is actually coming from the stillness. It does not matter what object you look at. Everything becomes so beautiful. That is a sign. The insight is happening. It is a piti sukha, the joy of happiness, which is empowering your mindfulness. It's one of the insights which I first heard from a monk like Najan Chah, and later found in obscure parts of the Buddhist teachings, that the energy of the mind comes from stillness. The energy of the body comes from exercise. In other words, the more you think, the less mental energy you have. You get tired out, which is another cause of depression. When you become still, when the mind is aloof, the energy becomes so strong and powerful. And that mental energy is happiness. It is sick. Those people who are dumb, who have got no mental energy, have also got no mental happiness. Those people who have powerful minds are always very happy. That's a sign which I have of people's meditation. Not to tell me profound things, but just to see how happy you are. The best sign of success in meditation is the shape of the human mouth. If it's turned down at the sides, then your meditation is hopeless. Even if it's horizontal, it's still not good enough. If it's turned up on the edges, so the edges are almost meeting the ears, then you're getting some good meditation. Because the piti sukha, the energy. To put it in another way, which is very, very important to understand, your mental energy can go into two directions. One direction, the most normal channel, is into thinking and doing and controlling. So much of your mental energy is employed in thinking, planning, controlling, managing. You have got very little left for the other half of the mind, called passive knowing. Two halves of the mind, what I usually call the doer, thinking, managing, controlling, the doer. And the other half, the knower, the passive, that which can hear me, that which can feel the body, that which can see, the knower behind things. Another one is what reacts, the doer. So much of your energy goes into doing things.
managing, planning, thinking. There's hardly any energy left for knowing.
The knower, mindfulness, just gets the scraps left over. And it's because of that that most people aren't mindful. Their energy of knowing is very weak. But on a retreat, when you're doing meditation, you have very little to do. The food is prepared for you. I give you the instructions. You don't need to talk to anybody. You've got no business or shopping to do. You can't answer your mobile phones. You've got nothing to do. And what happens when you have nothing to do? The energy can now flow into mindfulness. You will find, as long as you don't think too much, that the energy starts to increase and increase. And by the end of the 4 days, your mind becomes more powerful, more still, and see deeper. That's a sign that the energy is now flowing into the knowing, not into the doing. As it flows into the knowing, you are giving mindfulness power. The seeing deeper. Whatever you look at, you can hold the attention there. And the mindfulness pours into it effortlessly. So you see more details, much more than you ever expected to see. And what you see is just so lovely. This is what happens. And as we mindfulness gets more and more powerful, more and more energetic, that is the sort of mindfulness which is required for seeing the Dhamma. Power mindfulness. Deep, still, penetrating energy of the mind. For those of you who ever experience such power mindfulness, you'll see, experience, whatever you look at, you can hold and see so much more. You understand why that degree of mindfulness is what's necessary. To see what the Buddha said is hard to see and hard to penetrate the Dhamma. So in order to create that stillness of the mind, in order to allow the energy to go into the knowing and not into the doing, we have these practices like Anapana. Don't never think that Anapana Sati is Samatha. That is a misconception which should be abandoned long ago. There's still some, even Marx keeps teaching that. For those of you who doubt me, actually the book is upstairs in the cabinet, Majjhima Nikaya, middle exam by translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Look in the Anapanasati Sutta, number 118, Majjhima Nikaya. And there you will see, as I mentioned to somebody last night, the Buddha said, anyone who practices the 16 steps of Anapanasati also fulfills completely the 4 Satipatthanas. So, Anapanasati is not samatha practice. It's Satipatthana practice. That's what the Buddha said, not what I said. Once there was a very happy couple, Mrs. Samatha and Mr. Vipassana. And one day, because it was a wonderful afternoon, they decided to have a walk up the hill. Mrs. Samatha wanted to go up the hill because it was so peaceful and quiet at the top. Mr. Vipassana, he wanted to go up there to enjoy the beautiful view. So they both went up the same hill for different things. One went up there for the peace and calm, the other went up there for the beautiful view. They went up there together, and when they reached the top, Mrs. Samatha, oh, she enjoyed the peace, it was so quiet up there. But she also saw the view. She had a pair of eyes. And her husband, Mr. Vipassana, he saw the wonderful view, but he also experienced the very wonderful peace as well. Because on top of the hill, there's the peace and the beauty. You may think you're going up there for one, but you will also experience the other. Because in meditation, samatha and vipassana, calm and insight always go together. If you don't go slowly up the hillside, you never see. If you don't allow the mind to be still, the energy will always be lost in doing, thinking, planning, controlling. And you'll never get the power of mindfulness. Calm and insight will always go together. So don't think that Ajahn Brahm teaches samatha. Don't think that Ajahn Brahm teaches vipassana. All we teach is Dhamma. There's no difference there. And sometimes people try to make those differences. Sometimes it's called conceit. You think that my path is better than the other one's path. And that really made it speak when we started to have the different traditions of Buddhism. Mahayana and Vajrayana. I gave first, I wrote an article in, I think it was published in Shambhala Sun, which is, has many Tibetan articles as well. And when I said, well, there is no shortcut to Nirvana, the only path is the Eightfold Path. And straight after that, there was an article by the Dzogchen practitioner, a Tibetan. And he started off his article by saying, the Buddha taught three yanas, Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana. And guess which of those yanas Theravada is slotted into? We're the Hinayana, which does not mean small vehicle. Hina means gross, contemptible, mean, lowly. It's actually very, very a bad word. And then Mahayana and Vajrayana. And he said, we're not just Vajrayana, we're the highest of the Vajrayana. And this is the shortcut to Vipassana. When you read stuff like that, you think, to say, what a conceited quote that was, he said that. To say that I am the best, that my path is the best of the best. Please understand that it's such what we call spiritual materialism or spiritual conceit has got no part in Buddhism, no part in the Dhamma. Go back to what Buddha said. The path is the Eightfold Path. And there's not two parts of the Eightfold Path, not the Vipassana Eightfold Path or the Samatha Eightfold Path, it's the Eightfold Path. So please practice that Eightfold Path because that's the way to achieve the enlightenment. And that is the best of all paths, said the Buddha, as in a Dhamma Path. So this way we understand what we should be doing. By creating stillness, we create wisdom. By creating wisdom, we create more stillness. This is why one of my favorite sayings of the Buddha, verse 372 of the Dhammapada, Nati Jhanam Apanyasa. There is no jhana for people without wisdom. Panya Nati Ajayato. There is no wisdom for people without the jhanas. Yami Jhanam Chapanya Chan. But for the one in whom there is both wisdom and jhana, sawe nibbana santike. They are in the presence of nibbana. So as I said last night, you don't get jhana through willpower, you get it through wisdom power. There's no jhana without wisdom. And you can't sort of take some shortcut to become enlightened without jhanas. There's no wisdom without jhana, verse 2. But when you have jhana and wisdom, then in the presence of the Dhamma. So said our Lord Buddha. That's why the two go together. The jhana and the wisdom, Mr. Samatha or Mrs. Samatha and Mr. Vipassana, always go together. So what does that mean for how you practice? What it means for how you practice is that when you first start on this retreat, your mental energy will be low. Which is why that many of you will fall asleep. You'll get dull and dozy. If that's what happens to you, well done. It's much better to have dozy, sleepy people than restless people who can't even have a moment of peace. Once the Buddha was walking, I was trying to find actually where this quote comes from. I read it a long time ago. Once the Buddha was walking with his attendant, Ananda, and they came across a monk at the edge of the forest who was sitting in meditation in a perfect posture, his back straight, his head just slightly tilted with his hands in his lap, absolutely still. And the Buddha looked at him and turned to Ananda and said, "I'm worried about you." And 2 weeks later, that monk, the disciple, got married. They went deeper into the jungle, and there they saw another monk meditating, nodding this way and nodding that way, as you do when you have stopping torpor. And the Buddha turned to them, Ananda, his attendant, and smiled and said, "I'm not worried about him." And 2 weeks later, he was an arahant with all the psychic powers. And when I read that story, I thought, that can't be right. They got it the wrong way around. But no, the Buddha doesn't get things the wrong way around. Even Mahamoggallana was also one of the famous novels. And we all know what happened to Venerable Mahamoggallana. But what's happening here is the reason you get dull in meditation is simply the result of old karma. You've been thinking a lot. You've been running around. You've been having to work to arrange this retreat or arrange the time so you can come here. It's nature that you're tight. You cannot fight nature. You work with nature. When I was in Thailand for my first years of monk, I had terrible stopping torpor. And I used to fight it, use my willpower. And when I would break through the stopping torpor, I was so restless, I couldn't stop thinking. So I'd calm my thoughts down and then go to sleep again. It was like a pendulum swinging from stop and torpor into restlessness and back into stop and torpor again. And for a couple of years there was a big problem and I did not know what to do. I found a solution. And when you see it, it's so obvious. The reason I was sleeping is because I was a Westerner in a climate which was so hot and humid in the jungles. We were only supposed to sleep 4 hours a night. So I was sleep deprived. The food, I mentioned some of the food we used to eat in northeast Thailand, like frog and rice. It was not nutritious. I was malnourished in a hot climate with not enough sleep. And we'd sometimes sit meditation all night. No wonder I was tired. It was nature of the body. It wasn't used to things like that. It was a result of old karma. So if you're feeling sleepy now, or any time during the retreat, remember it's just the result of old karma. It's nothing to do with you. So when you have that situation, what should you do? Don't make any more unschooled karma. Stop fighting. Stop feeling just so embarrassed that you're sleepy. It's nature. Make peace with it. Because when you make peace, gentleness, kindness with whatever you experience, you're making a skillful karma which will create positive states in the very near future. I learned when I was sleepy to accept it as part of the natural cause and effect system. So I allowed myself to be sleepy. I never fought it. And because of that, the little energy which my brain had was not wasted fighting what was only a natural phenomenon. And because I never wasted my energy in doing, I just, as well as I could, and you can't know sleepiness too well, I was just mindful of it without trying to fight it. But I said yesterday, unconditional mindfulness. Mindfulness which is not judging, mindfulness which is not trying to control things, mindfulness which is gentle and accepting and peaceful. When I was just mindful with it,
it soon disappeared. And when it disappeared, what was left was not restlessness anymore, but a beautiful peace which got deeper and deeper and deeper. Because I was being still, I was allowing energy to flow into knowing, into mindfulness. And the energy started pouring into that mindfulness, because it wasn't wasted in doing, controlling, fighting. And the mind got more and more peaceful, more and more bright. If I wanted to watch the breath, it was so easy to do. Try watching the breath at 4 o'clock in the morning, before you've had your cup of tea. And then watch the breath, say 10 minutes after your cup of tea. You'll find it's much easier after a cup of tea. Because your mind has got more energy. Even though it comes from the caffeine, still you understand how much easier it is to watch and observe things once you have energy in the mind. Now this is not energy from caffeine. This is energy from stillness. A natural source. And the more still you are, the brighter is the mind. And the brighter the mind, the more you can see within. Which is why once you get into this whole process of stilling the mind, the more still you are, the brighter is your awareness. Because it's brighter, you can see more. You see more of the breath. Which is why when people start watching the breath, they can't watch it very long. You wander off. You're not sure what you're trying to see. All it is that your mind is not strong enough yet to really see the breath. Later on during this retreat, you'll find your mind becomes so strong. It's so easy to watch the breath. You can sit here and watch the breath sometimes for hours. Why can't I always do this? It's because you've got energy now in the mind. It's peaceful, it's still. Mindfulness is powerful now. It's so easy to watch. And as the breath becomes more still and more subtle, your awareness is powerful enough to see the subtle breath. Which means that when the breath starts to calm down, become very, very refined, only now, because you have power of mindfulness, can you follow that stage. Some people complain that they're watching the breath and it disappears. All that's happening is your mind is not strong enough yet. You've been doing too much, fighting too much, so the awareness isn't sharp. Bear with that, make more stillness, and the mindfulness will get stronger and stronger. You'll be able to deal with those refined stages of the meditation. But when you get to the very subtle breath, it's common at that stage that the mindfulness is not only sharp enough and powerful enough, it's also joyful. Which is why the Buddha said that we develop that stage of breath meditation where we breathe in and out, experiencing pity and sutta, the joy and delight. That's where that comes from. The more still you are, you're not just seeing a breath, but what you see is very, very delightful. It's a beautiful breath. And hopefully you get to that stage where you're sitting down and just watching the breath going in and out, so refined. It's the most wonderful thing you're looking at. You can sit there for hours, completely happy. And I mentioned last night, when people get into that stage for the first time, and it's time for lunch, they just don't want to get up and have lunch. They're just sitting there watching the breath, and they're just so happy. No, this is more important, more enjoyable than my lunch. You just carry on sitting there, having a wonderful time. You're not forcing yourself. You're not trying to be on the first person on the retreat to get into enlightenment. It's not coming from the ego, it's coming from nature. The breath is just so lovely, so delightful, you just can't take your attention away from it. The happiness is starting to grow. And that's a sign that mindfulness is becoming powerful. So much so that when the breath gets so refined it turns off, your mindfulness and energy is strong enough to be able to experience the next stage, which is the nirvana stage, seeing the beautiful light in the mind. If your mindfulness is not strong enough, you're not energized enough, it means when the breath disappears, it's just blank, it's nothing. You don't know what to do, and there's nothing much you can do. Instead, be still there. Hopefully have enough stillness that the energy starts to come in. Lighten up the mind, giving enough power and happiness, you can see it. But you have to have the powerful mindfulness, which has a lot of joy associated with it, to be able to see the real universe. Which is why in Anapanasati Sutta the Buddha mentioned that very clearly. Develop pity and sukha with the breath. The beautiful breath, the delightful breath. All coming because you practice a lot of stillness. For those of you who try to control the breath, or control the mind, I'm going to watch the breath, every in-breath, every out-breath. Some of you have got enough willpower to be able to do that. You can watch every in-breath and every out-breath for an hour, say, but purely out of will. You'll find you won't be able to go any deeper. You won't get the joy and happiness. You'll be able to watch the breath that never is delightful. Simply because your energy is all going into controlling, making it happen. Instead, you should do a more calm, peaceful stillness. Stillness is more important than the breath. As I said last night, it's not so much what you're watching, but how you're watching. Which brings me up to the hindrances. You know the five hindrances of Nirvana? What are those Nirvana? What's number one? Kamachanda, which is the delight or the interest in the five senses. Why is it that you get disturbed by sound? Nothing to do with you. You know why? It's because it's not the sound that disturbs us. It's we who disturb the sound. We're so attached to hearing. You can't listen to something. Why is the body always disturbs you? Because you can't let the body go. You actually want to find out what's happening down there. This is the karma chanda. We understand karma chanda is overcome when the body disappears. What's the next hindrance? Ill will. Again, ill will is, I want to get the jhana, I don't want to be here. I don't want to fall asleep. I don't want to stop and talk. That's ill will. Ill will and karma chanda, they all make you do something. Which is why they stop the mindfulness growing strong. They give you business to be done. So you get mentally tired. And that's the cause of stop and talk. The remedy of stop and talk be more still, not to exert more will. That's a big mistake which I made for many years and other people continue to make. Thinking that the remedy for stop and torpor is trying harder. The remedy is actually the opposite, try less. Sure, you don't get immediate results, but long term, stop and torpor soon disappears and you are flying high. Restlessness is a fourth hindrance. Again, which is a lack of stillness. And skeptical doubt, not quite sure what's going on. A lot of times you're not looking in the right place. The power of the mind is much stronger. All these hindrances, where do they live? They don't live in your mind. Otherwise the mind could never be pure. They don't live in the object which you're watching. They don't live in the breath. The hindrances lie between you and your breath. It doesn't matter what you're watching. It's how you're watching it. It's the how where the hindrances lie. So it doesn't matter what you're experiencing. If you're leaving it alone, letting it be, being trying, being gentle, letting it go, making peace, not war. No matter what you're watching, you are not encouraging the hindrances. There's no ill will. There's no desire. You're wanting it with peace. Then you'll find you're suppressing the hindrances. You're suppressing the doer. And the mindfulness gets stronger and stronger and stronger. That's why the Buddha mentioned the five hindrances are what weaken wisdom. They disempower mindfulness. It's the busyness of the mind is what the hindrances are trying to destroy. But you let go more and more, make peace more and more. Don't fight, just know. You'll find the hindrances disappear. And with that you get power mindfulness. And the whole path becomes so clear, so easy. So if ever any of you have any problem while you're meditating, it doesn't matter what you're experiencing. What you're experiencing is a result of all karma. What's important is how you're experiencing it. Make sure it's not with desire or ill will. Making peace exist. Being still. And that is the karmic cause for the mind to be energized, to have lots of mindfulness, which will empower you to be able to go into the deeper meditations. From stillness, you get power. The power of mindfulness. Without powerful mindfulness, it's so easy to get into the deepest of meditations. So that's how it works. So, I thought for an hour. What questions have you got for what I've just been saying? The main point of what I've just been saying is the stillness leads to mindfulness. Activity leads in the opposite direction. I think you all know the 8 precepts now. So really you don't need to take them from a bhikkhu, because sometimes people take them from a bhikkhu and they're still fake. The most important thing is you resolve in your heart to keep them. So even when you're at home, you can always take them in front of a Buddha statue, or just sit down and just take them. Resolve to keep them. So I think each one of you knows those 8 precepts, not to kill a living being, not to steal, not to have any sexuality at all during this retreat, not to to lie. Here you're keeping noble silence, which means you're not speaking at all. So it's very easy to keep that precept. No alcohol or non-medicinal drugs. You're not having any solid food in the afternoon or evening or at night time. If any of you have any medical condition, please come see me. You have special permission to take something if you need to. But otherwise, just eat like I do, just in the morning and lunchtime. And we don't wear any ornaments, no makeup, which means that everyone is seen for who they really are. It's amazing what we can do with makeup these days. Even the ugliest of women can look actually beautiful. And the most gross of men can look interesting. So no makeup, no jewellery, no entertainment. Keep it simple. And also we use just simple furnishings. That's the 8 precepts. In other words, we're restrained the next 4 days. So we keep these 8 precepts as not just what you keep while you're in these 2 houses or 3 houses. Don't leave the 8 precepts here when you go home at night. Take them home with you so they're there for you all night. I usually like to keep ritual and ceremonies to a minimum on a retreat so I can spend more time focusing on the development of the mind. Is physical stillness and how the stillness of the mind? It certainly does. It usually precedes the mental stillness. So it's wonderful to understand how physical stillness comes about. You cannot hold your body still. You can never keep the body still by an act of will. is only when you take your attention away from the body. Basically, you're not concerned about it anymore. Only then does it become still. When you try and hold the body still, or you have the awareness of your body, knowing where your legs are, your hands are, you will always be irritated by the body. So you just look around your firm between us. Now they're moving their legs, they're moving their arms, so they're scratching, they're just moving their hands or twiddling their feet, or moving their hands around or the fingers around. I'm just watching what people are doing here in front of me. You're always moving. Why is that? It's because the body is always irritating. It's always something to move, to scratch. As long as you give your body attention. But it's amazing, some people say they can't sit still. They say they can't meditate for more than 10 minutes. They can watch a cricket match for hours without moving. And why is that? It's because their attention is fully away from their body. They're watching on the next ball. What move it's going to do. When you are watching with such attention outside of yourself, you don't feel the body anymore. It's gone. And that's how you become still, by taking attention away from the body. Which is why we watch the breath. And I said last night when I first went to watch the breath, it was at the tip of the nose. But I have hay fever. So watching there is all itchy, and sometimes you sneeze. And then the next thing I learned was actually watching your belly. Well, that didn't work either, because it's a mark. As soon as I washed my belly, I started feeling hungry. It's a big question of my stomach. But the best thing is just to watch the breath without focusing on any part of the body. But I call like disembodying the breath. So you know the breath's going in and out, but you don't know where it's going in and out. So you're taking your attention away from the body, and then you can sit absolutely still. Because your attention's not on your body anymore. That's how you get stillness of the body. By taking the tension away from the body. It disappears. And then it's still. And that really helps. Because the body is so demanding. Even the Buddha said this. The only time he was freed from physical suffering was when he was in deep meditation. And I think each one of you are holding up now. There's always many aches and pains. You sit like this for long enough, you get an ache here, a pain here. That's nature. If you take your attention away from the body, there's no pain, there's no ache, there's no itch anymore. You're free. And that is wonderful. That gives the mind freedom to be still. So it's correct. The tranquility of the body precedes the tranquility of the mind. Just a general instruction. Whatever you're doing in meditation, whatever you're experiencing, if the thought comes up, what should I do now? May an alarm bell sound. Stupid question. What you really mean is, what should I do next? You've lost present moment awareness. You're thinking of the next stage, the next moment, the next thing. Whenever you think like that, you've lost the present moment. So bring your mind back. Your job is not to drive the meditation into the next moment. It's just to know what's happening now. Not what should I do next. But just investigating passively what you're experiencing in this moment. Not trying to get anywhere else. But trying to be deeper into the present. Deepening the awareness of the present moment. You don't need to wonder, or think, or conceive of the next moment. Your job, your only job, is to care for the now. And if you care for the present moment, that's the best way of making a beautiful and peaceful future. Look after this moment. And all subsequent moments will also be pure and beautiful. If you neglect this moment, as you plan for the next, as the future of your meditation. When neglecting this moment, no wonder the meditation never succeeds. So all you ever need to do is to care for this moment. Be mindful now. Forget about the next moment. Let's call it here. The second time, is there any questions? Going, gone. Okay, I'm sure there'll be some more questions later on. And again, you can write them on pieces of paper if you need to. But now we have another 15 minutes before we have a tea break at 10 o'clock, if I remember correctly. Okay,
yes.
So now we can meditate together for 15 minutes. For those of you who have got sore knees, you can stand up. I'm going to stand up because I'm doing it by example. And you can wiggle your legs around to give your circulation a chance to come back so that you can exercise to make your body comfortable enough before you sit for 50 minutes.